My name is Jill Phillips, and I'm the creator of Who's Shoes, a popular approach to co-production. I was named as an HSJ 100 wildcard and want to help give a voice to others talking about their ideas and experiences. I'll be chatting with people from all sorts of different perspectives, walking in their shoes. If you are interested in the future of healthcare and like to hear what other people think, or perhaps even contribute at some point, Who's Shoes Wildcard is for you. So I'm absolutely delighted today to welcome Dr. Tim Fawns. Tim, it was one of your students, Katie Callum, who introduced you to me as someone who is ahead of his time about how he thinks that adult learners should learn. So this was in the context of clinical education and digital education. And I've met Katie through an amazing network that I've got around the Who's Shoes work we're doing in neonatal care. And we can perhaps talk about that a bit more in terms of networking and how important it is. So, Tim, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and what's important to you?
Sure. Thanks a lot, Jill, for having me on this podcast. It's a very exciting moment for me. And thanks as well to Katie for putting us in touch. Katie's one of our students, or she's a graduate now, actually, on our online Masters in Clinical Education at the University of Edinburgh. And I teach on that program, and it's wonderful in terms of networking because we have lots and lots of students come through each year, and they are clinicians and they're clinical educators. So they are teachers who teach other clinicians, and we educate them about education. So it's very sort of meta, if you like. But what's great about it is that we end up with a really large network of international educators, some of whom are quite influential, many of whom are very, very knowledgeable in various areas. So they bring a lot of knowledge to that program, and I learn a lot through that, and my colleagues do too. I also have a background in digital education. I was never a clinician, but I came through as a learning technologist working in the Department of Clinical Psychology at the University of Edinburgh before moving on to become a lecturer in clinical education with a kind of digital education background. I did a master's in digital education at Edinburgh. I also did a PhD in technology and education at Edinburgh. So one of my big interests is in how technology relates to education and then how all of that relates to clinical education. So I have a sort of interdisciplinary mix to me.
That's really interesting. So, I mean, this isn't my area. I mean, I think the nearest that I can relate to, and I guess it is quite similar. I work with the Darcy Fellows with London South Bank University. So Professor Becky Mulby has got me involved using Who's Shoes with their co-production module. And I meet clinicians from all sorts of different backgrounds. So I suppose in terms of how I see them learning, and I think you described, and perhaps you could talk a bit more in a minute about your collegiate system of learning. I see that a big synergy, I think, in terms of how Professor Mulby works with her students in terms of bringing all the expertise in the room rather than just an expert imparting facts.
Well, yeah, we work very much to this kind of aspirational model that we've developed together. So my close colleagues, Jill Aitken and Derek Jones, who've been on our program for a while, they've been instrumental in helping us develop a program philosophy. And we talk about that across the wider team. We've spent just an awful lot of time in conversation about what is it that we value in our educational practice. How can we articulate that as a sort of philosophical position that we can use to inform everything we do on the program? And over the years, we've honed that into these principles. They're aspirational principles of hospitality, collegiality, and advocacy. And these help us guide our decision-making. So hospitality is the idea that you don't prejudge who it is that is going to turn up on your program, who the students are going to be, and you allow them to be who they are, and you try to make space for them. So part of that is not being directive about what should be learned, not being too prescriptive, and trying to bring students into the discussions that happen at the time and where possible to contribute to the future design of the program itself. And part of that is an emphasis on community building and relationship building. And I'll talk about that a bit later because there's a lot to say about how we go about building relationships with our students. But we also have this principle of collegiality where we try to position, and I stress really that these are aspirations. So we fall short of these aspirations in many ways a lot of the time, but we always hold those aspirations so that we can keep going in that direction. So collegiality, we try to position the students as equal with the teachers rather than having this hierarchy, respecting the knowledge and expertise and experiences that they bring to our course and learning from them as much as they learn from us. And then the final principle is advocacy, where we always try to position ourselves on the same side, the same team, the same, well, hopefully there are no sides, but, you know, being on the same team as the students so that if anything goes wrong, either with what we're doing or with what they're doing, that it isn't one side judging the other, but actually working together to try and make things better. So a good example is we're a fully online program. There are technical issues that come up. And if we do a good job of being on the same team as the students, then the students don't get annoyed with us for technical problems, but they just jump in and try to help us work through them collaboratively. So it's trying to create this collaborative atmosphere where teachers and students all work together on this project of their education. And we learn from that too.
This is so interesting, and there's so much synergy in terms of what I do with Who Shoes and some of our really key concepts. So you could look on Twitter, there's a big hashtag, no hierarchy, just people. And that seems very, very similar, different context. But when we have our workshops, we deliberately say, do not introduce yourselves around the table. It's not that people are hiding who they are, but as soon as I say, I'm the chief executive, remind me who you are. You get the hierarchy, you know, and people will not speak openly and honestly. But if I'm Jill and you're Tim and everybody else has just got a name badge, and then it comes up naturally, as we've done, hopefully, who you are and a bit more about you, and you get to know each other as people, then you're creating that level playing field. And I think that's what you're doing with your students, which is brilliant. And the other thing I heard was about being on the same team. So it's the same kind of idea, but a different sort of slant on it. And one of the most powerful cards that we've had, really, one of the most powerful scenarios in Who's Shoes has been around us and them, and who is your us and them. And perhaps some of the work that we've done with care homes, it might be that the catering staff or the care staff, they both want the best for the people, but the practicality of running a kitchen and ordering staff against the personalization of people having choice, and perhaps the farmer who always got up and had his breakfast at 5 in the morning, or the woman with dementia who might want to wander into the kitchens and peel carrots all day. You know, I'm just coming up with some quick examples, but I think as soon as people suddenly kind of almost pop the balloon and realise that we're all on the same team and all trying to do the best, but just coming at it from different perspectives, which is of course where Who's Shoes comes in. So very, very interesting.
Yeah, it is. And it really opens up a lot of possibilities once you start thinking like that. There are, as I said, it's aspirational. So there are things that get in the way. Assessment can get in the way. We need to mark the work of students. Evaluations can get in the way, where students are giving feedback on the on their experience of the program. But having said that, actually, you can still have open conversations about all of these things and establish, sort of negotiate how we're all approaching them. So we have many conversations about assessment. Postgraduate is quite different from undergraduate. And so we can have these conversations about what the value of having a mark is, what it means. To us, not really that much, because nobody will ask a postgraduate student on our program what mark they got. After the fact, you get a qualification, that's good. And what's more important to us and to, I think, most of our students is what they learn. So the importance of the mark disappears a bit or fades into the background, and we can have these open conversations about what does the mark even mean? Is it like just a snapshot of what happened right now? And actually, we'll get onto it, I'm sure, the pandemic, but this throws a whole different light on everything, because the mark you got during a pandemic is probably even less representative of you than it ever was before, that marks ever were before. So I think that the light that the pandemic has shone on education is really interesting. But yes, so certain structures can make it harder to have this collegiality and this sort of flattened hierarchy. But we just continuously work on that in discussion with students.
So for me, I got, I think, my first lemon light bulb there. We were talking before about lemon light bulbs and like the difference between undergraduate and postgraduate education, which I'm sure is completely obvious to you. And it's perhaps obvious to me once I think about it, and the perhaps different relationships with students. But something I was interested in is how you work with students. And I know we've talked about this a little bit beforehand in terms of equalities and what actually is equal. So perhaps if a student, you know, you might have a brilliant student, but then they're not well, we're in a pandemic, so as you say, it's even worse at the moment, they might have a young family. How do you be fair in terms of requirements and flexibility of the course? And do you think that's changing as, you know, modern programs evolve?
Yeah, this is a very, very interesting and complicated area, fairness, equality, equity, etc. And it relates quite closely to principles of inclusivity and diversity. And again, there are many structures that can get in the way of how we would want to approach equity and inclusivity. Assessment is one of them, again, because you end up kind of funneling people through a certain lens in some ways when you assess summatively, and you have criteria and everyone needs to meet those, and you have designs of assessment that everyone needs to conform to that may or may not suit the particular individuals. But what we do as a team is we try to use our discretion where we can to kind of erode some of the hard lines here. You know, we try to treat each situation on its own merits rather than assuming that because a student was late handing something in or whatever, that everyone has to be treated the same. We want to find out a little bit about why that was and try to be lenient. So we would try to err on the sort of the side of lenience and flexibility, but we might sometimes be acting against institutional policy that is the opposite. And, you know, let's see who ends up coming out on top. and I mean, there's a conversation that I saw happening, I think it was on Twitter recently, about to what extent might students be using the current situation to create excuses for handing in work late or getting special circumstances, and what do we do about that? And this might be contentious, but my view is we really just need to, the default position for me has to be believing people.
Yeah.
People really do have a lot going on. People's mental health has been stretched very far over the last 18 months and already before that. So the greater risk to me is that you don't believe someone than that you do believe someone and they might take advantage, you know, discuss. But that's the view that we take, because I think we need to trust our students and we need to trust them by default. And that trust is then the basis for building relationships with them where we can get to know them and work with them. And if it turns out that we discover that they were kind of stretching the truth or whatever, if we ever did discover that, then we would want to know the reason for that as well. We wouldn't assume that they did that out of callousness or whatever. So the trust is the basis for the relationship, and the relationship then allows you to understand what's actually going on, and then that allows you to do something about that.
So I'm loving this conversation. I think the fact that, you know, you're talking about trust and how that could be controversial, which I can absolutely see in the kind of tensions between perhaps the university and standards, and again, this is, you know, kind of what I try and do really through Whose Shoes, to tease out some of these issues that are a bit more complex and a lot more human than perhaps is obvious initially. And it reminds me, before I set up Whose Shoes, I was working in social care. That's my background, and I was around at the time when they first started introducing personal budgets. And personal budgets can be the most amazing thing. So, for example, I remember a mother of a young man with learning disabilities and how they'd been used to having ridiculous numbers of carers that they didn't know coming in and out of their house as if it was their house, and just so impersonal, and how they'd managed to use a personal budget to employ people that actually related to their son and you know, got him doing the things that were important to him. But the issue that came up was trust. And surely these people will go off and spend their budgets on cigarettes and drugs and alcohol. And it didn't happen because people are responsible and they have got, they come into a situation. I mean, certainly being a student and the cost of things these days, they don't come lightly. They come because they really want to or need to learn that course. And again, it was interesting to me because I've got a friend who would make the most amazing clinician in her particular field that she's applied for. She's actually given up a very serious job to go into to this field that she's passionate about, but is struggling with young children and struggling with that lack of flexibility. And sometimes that can even be that you've prepared to do one thing and you've got everything lined up in your personal life, and then something arbitrarily changes. And perhaps for other students, without the responsibilities, that might just be annoying or doesn't matter. But for other people, it could be a showstopper. So I love the way that you're kind of recognising all those different factors. And I think I can see why Katie says you're very forward thinking. That's nice.
Thanks very much. I think there's a principle here that education isn't really done by teachers to students. Is a collaborative kind of collective enterprise. And so if a student has some sort of issue, then we need to look beyond just that student. You know, what is it that makes someone not able to get work in on time? Or what is it that makes them behave in a particular way? Does it really just reflect the student, or does it sometimes also reflect the context that this is all happening in? Maybe they did need some more flexibility because they have children or they have caring responsibilities. And often I think we don't try to find that out. We just say, well, this is the rule and they knew that when they signed up for it. So one of the things we try never to do is to say they knew what they were getting into when they signed up for this program. And hopefully the pandemic has kind of highlighted why that's problematic. Nobody can predict the future to the extent that they always know what they signed up for or how it's going to play out or what support they're going to need or what circumstances will change during the course of their study that they then need to be able to deal with. And it's really the teachers and the students and the administrators and the institution and the wider context and culture that are contributing to this educational activity that's happening. And sometimes you need to address more than just one of those things in order to create a better future.
I think one of the lemon light bulbs that's kind of emerging through the series, even though it's in such an early stage, is be curious. And I think that idea of understanding and being interested and curious about the context and actually listening. Another one that's kind of just sparked in my mind really was the work we've done with Who Shoes around admin. So admin in hospitals, and it's fascinating, you know, and sometimes the administrator, you can have a fantastic person, perhaps a receptionist, and people are coming to them asking questions and they're being set up to fail because they don't know the answers to those questions, but they're expected to know the answers. And if you kind of dig behind it a bit and find out what's going on in the wider system and perhaps how things could be improved by, you know, it's working together, isn't it, all of this? So rather than having the us and thems with admin and lecturers and students and never the twain, three of them should meet, you know.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely crucial. You want to break down all these partitions and silos. And we are very fortunate to have the greatest administrator in the world, Debbie Spence, on our program. She'd be very embarrassed if she ever hears that.
She won't see me clapping because it's a podcast.
And she is an exemplar of the sorts of contribution that people with good administrative knowledge can make and of the way that academics and administrators can work closely together, or let's say clinicians and administrators can work really closely together to produce things that work well for everyone. So I've said before that our program is really focused on this community and the relationship building. And what we do is, as soon as somebody indicates that they might be interested in applying for our program, so this is as early as possible, Debbie will be in touch with them and she will start building a relationship with that person just by being herself and being very helpful and informative. And she will then, if they apply, she will help them through the application process. Not everybody does this. You know, most people, I think, are left to themselves to fight through the system. And then they already have this relationship with Debbie before they start. And then she's part of the induction that happens. And then the rest of the program team come in to the induction and get to know these students. But they already know Debbie. So we've got this kind of running start, if you like, on the community aspect that's done through Debbie just being brilliant at administration, but the sort of human side of administration where actually helping people navigate systems is important. It isn't just a chore, and it makes a significant difference if you can kind of smooth things out for people. But she's such an integrated part of the team that it makes it easier for her to help people, because she knows all about the program and she knows what we do and how we think about things. So she contributes to our governance and our leadership and our decision-making, and we all sort of work together. So it's, again, it's this kind of everyone working on this educational project together.
So I think for me that's another lemon light bulb in terms of, yeah, special people are gold. It isn't about the position that you're in. It's about who you are and building those relationships. And I think one of the concepts we've got is nobody is just a whoever it might be. So, you know, trying to strip away this hierarchy, the work we do around maternity care, nobody is just a mum or just a parent or just a receptionist or just a cleaner. We find that everybody has got their wisdom to offer. And sometimes we've got a poem actually around a hospital porter, and basically he can see what's going wrong, but nobody thinks to ask him because he's having those conversations with people and building those relationships in everything that he does or she does, you know. So, I mean, it applies across the board, doesn't it? That to kind of value people and build teamworking, and everybody's an equal member of that team. And within that team, you're going to get some people who, you know, they're going above and beyond, aren't they? And that's adding so much value to your course that people have got that relationship. Another thing that sort of comes to mind is in maternity, they talk a lot, there's a big national program around continuity of carer, but it's continuity of relationships really. And Debbie is your continuity of carer in a way for your students.
Yeah, she is. And the analogies to clinical practice that you've made there are really good ones. I think it is that, you know, you can find real value everywhere you look if you've got the right people doing, you know, knowing how to do their jobs, and especially if they're allowed to do what they know, you know, what they value.
And again, that's such an important thing in terms of the team you work in, whether you're allowed to bring your whole self to work, and that could include your personal interests or anything really. And some organizations seem to take that very, very naturally and build it. My son's a teacher, but he's a maths teacher, but also a sportsman. And to actually, you know, have a job that blends both of those and brings out the most for the children is much better than just being, you know, categorized as one or the other.
Definitely. Yeah, there's interesting stuff about identity here, isn't there? And how do you see yourself, and how fixed are you in not only your own identity, but how you think that particular type of role should work? And there's a real tension in education, and I'm sure in clinical practice, between standardization and sort of local discretion, if you like, and how much can you improvise and how much do you have to conform to the system? Because the systems, there needs to be a balance, or there needs to be a sort of combination of both. You do need some standardization, and you need some consistency and people understanding how the wider thing works. But if you lock everything down too tightly, then people can't operate according to the expertise that they've developed or the values that they've developed. And so there's this constant sort of negotiation of the balance of structure and agency, if you like, or standardization and discretion.
I think that's a really good way of explaining it. And I know I've been fascinated. I don't know if you follow Rob Webster on Twitter, and I think he's probably was quite instrumental in me becoming a wildcard. I don't know. He's a fantastic chief executive of an integrated care system, big area in South Yorkshire. But Rob was the one that introduced me to the idea of bring your whole self to work, and it was particularly around mental health. So it's breaking taboos as well, that if you're working in a mental health trust, do the staff have permission to show vulnerability and bring their own issues? You know, it's that whole thing about clinicians and professionalism and boundaries. And so that's the sort of thing I find really fascinating. And I don't know the answers, but I love it when people are pushing the boundaries and being a bit more forward thinking.
Well, that leads me on really nicely to a point that I wanted to make, which is around perfection and imperfection and mess. I've been working recently on this idea of imperfection. So to me, education is always imperfect, although sometimes we try to pretend that it is perfect and all streamlined. You know, you take, for example, a novice and you build this nice clear path from there to the outcomes that you want. So novice to expert, or beginner to master, or, you know, from not knowing to knowing. But in reality, things don't work out the way that we plan. So our designs are never perfect, actually. But also, they're always reinterpreted by the learners. They always are kind of modified by the conditions that they happen in. There's always some kind of subversion going on as well. You can't predict to the level of kind of precision that you would need to perfectly design a learning experience. You can only really design tasks and configure conditions, and then it sort of plays out in this messy reality a little bit differently from how you'd intended. And the pandemic, again, has really shown that. So what I think we need is, rather than pretending that it was all fine, we achieved all the learning outcomes that we said we were going to, and now we can move on, we want honesty and openness about what were the limitations of this educational experience, such that the learners have a good understanding of what they still need to go on and learn after the course. And then they can have a discussion about how they might go and learn that. And I know in medicine in particular, sometimes it's difficult to admit when you don't know something due to kind of the cultural history of the profession. And that can filter into teaching, where teachers feel like they need to present themselves as confident and knowing a lot of stuff. But actually, my preference would be that teachers were really open and honest about their own limitations, not pretending to know more than they did, and working with the students there and saying, how could we find out? How could we learn more? What is it that we would still need to do after this point in order to get to where everyone needs to be to do their future practice and developing principles for ongoing learning after the end of the course?
So there's a lot to take in there, Tim. That whole idea about honesty and openness and vulnerability and working together to get the best for everybody is one of the key things that have come out through this session. So thank you so much for that. And I wanted to, so you've picked up on the point you wanted to make, and it kind of builds into it really. I did a bit of crowdsourcing to say, you know, what questions should I ask Tim on our podcast today? And one of my Darcy friends, a wonderful paediatrician, who's now Associate Professor at the Health Systems Innovation Lab at London South Bank University. So Dr. Tom Holliday would like to ask you a question. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
So do you think the current system adequately prepares trainees for the complex reality that they will be faced with when they qualify? And if not, where do you think the gaps are and how could they be addressed?
Thanks, Tom. There's a big question and we're getting close to the end of the session. But there are, I think it doesn't adequately prepare people, but then I'm not sure that it ever could. So I think that we need to think of it not so much as, you know, graduates are ready, but really the undergraduate is just a step in the bigger process of becoming a clinician who really knows what they need to know or is ready. And you could even argue, are we ever really ready given the uncertainty that we practice in? So if you think of undergraduate as just one step, and, you know, the postgraduate as another step, and beyond that as another step, we need to just keep going forward. But I think that there's an issue in terms of dealing with uncertainty and complexity that we could do better. And then again, this issue that I brought up about imperfection and honesty, I think is really crucial here, that we shouldn't pretend, for one thing, that when someone has done their undergraduate training, they are fully fledged, because we know really that's not the case. And it's not the fault of the graduates, and it's not really the fault of the teachers. It's just that it isn't really possible in that structure, in that space of time, to get people, most professions anyway, that I am aware of, as far as they need to be, especially if they're not really embedded in practice in a way that they're actively participating. So I think there is always more to be done in allowing students to participate actively in practice settings as part of teams. And again, I would bring that relationship building and trust and things in there. We need somehow to be able to trust students to participate at a safe level in practice, and in a way where they feel like part of the team, and everybody knows who they are, and you actually have these personal connections between more senior members of the team and more junior members of the team. And in order to do that, we probably need to think a little bit differently about the relationship between patient care and education, which we tend to separate. And you'll have noticed the theme of mine is like worrying about these separations and trying to break them down. Does education have to be separated from patient care? Because if it is separated, then it will always be marginalized. It will never have priority over patient care. But if we can think of them as stuff that happened together, education as part of the practice of healthcare, then I think we have more scope for building it into practice. But there's a real cultural change that would need to happen, a cultural perspective. And I don't know if we have space to discuss all of that right now, but it comes down for me to trust, relationship building, openness, vulnerability, and a valuing of education and educational expertise as part of this negotiation of like practice and education at the same time.
Brilliant. So I can just feel an amazing, I don't know if you've picked up on our intentional coffee that we launched recently at the CoLab partnership event, but I can feel at some point an intentional coffee coming on between you and Tom Holliday, because Tom's really into wicked problems and, you know, uncertainty and complexity. And I just think that would be fascinating. I mean, perhaps we could even host that as another podcast at some time. It's all evolving.
I would love that.
Okay, well, we have come to what we thought would be a good kind of time so that Tom and others can listen on his commute on the train. So thank you so much, Tim, for being an early guest in this podcast series and believing in what we're trying to do here. It's been fascinating to talk to you, and thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Jill, and all the best with the podcast. I'm sure it's going to be absolutely fantastic.
Thank you. I hope you have enjoyed this episode. If so, please subscribe now to hear more of these fascinating conversations on your favourite podcast platform. And please leave a review. I tweet as Who's Shoes. Thank you for being on this journey with me. And let's hope that together we can make a difference.